The verb in four. Quack, quacks, quacked, quacking. In modern Italian and Spanish, every verb has about 50 forms. In classical Greek, 350. In Turkish, 2 million. Many of the languages I have brought up, such as Eskimo, Apache, Hopi, Kavunjo, and American Sign Language, are known for this prodigious ability. How do they do it? Here is an example from Kavunjo, the Bantu language that was said to make English look like checkers compared to chess. The verb naikimlalya, meaning he is eating it for her, is composed of 8 parts. N, a marker indicating that the word is the focus of that point in the conversation. A, a subject agreement marker. It identifies the eater as falling into class 1 of the 16 gender cases. Human, singular. Remember that to a linguist, gender means kind, not sex. Other genders embrace nouns that pertain to several humans, thin or extended objects, objects that come in pairs or clusters, the pairs or clusters themselves, instruments, animals, body parts, diminutives, small or cute versions of things, abstract qualities, precise locations, and general locales. I, present tense. Other tenses in Bantu can refer to today, earlier today, yesterday, no earlier than yesterday, yesterday or earlier, in the remote past, habitually, ongoing, consecutively, hypothetically, in the future, at an indeterminate time, not yet, and sometimes. Ki, an object agreement marker, in this case indicating that the thing eaten falls into gender class 7. M, a benefactive marker, indicating for those whose benefit the action is taking place, in this case, a member of gender class 1. Li, the verb to eat. I, an applicative marker, indicating that the verb's cast of players has been augmented by one additional role, in this case, the benefactive. As an analogy, imagine that in English we had to add a suffix to the verb bake when it is used in I baked her a cake, as opposed to the usual I baked a cake. Ah, a final vowel, which can indicate indicative versus subjunctive mood. If you multiply out the number of possible combinations of the 7 prefixes and suffixes, the product is about 500,000, and that is the number of possible forms per verb in the language. In effect, Kavunjo and languages like it are building an entire sentence inside a single complex word, the verb. But I have been a bit unfair to English. English is genuinely crude in its inflectional morphology, where one modifies a word to fit the sentence, like marking a noun for the plural with s, or a verb for past tense with ed. But English holds its own in derivational morphology, where one creates a new word out of an old one. For example, the suffix "able," as in learnable, teachable, and huggable, converts a verb meaning to do X into an adjective meaning capable of having X done to it. Most people are surprised to learn how many derivational suffixes there are in English. Here are the more common ones. Able, edge, all, an, ant, ants, airy, eight. Ed, en, full, hood, ick, ify, eon, ish, ism, ist, itty, I've, eyes, li, ment, ness, ori, us, e. In addition, English is free and easy with compounding, which glues 2 words together to form a new one, like toothbrush and mouse eater. Thanks to these processes, the number of possible words, even in morphologically impoverished English, is immense. The computational linguist Richard Sprote compiled all the distinct words used in the 44 million words of text from Associated Press news stories beginning in mid-February 1988. Up through December 30th, the list contained 300,000 distinct word forms, about as many as in a good unabridged dictionary. You might guess that this would exhaust the English words that would ever appear in such stories. But when Sproat looked at what came over the wire on December 31st, he found no fewer than 35 new forms, including instrumenting, counterprograms, armhole, part Vulcan, fuzzier, groveled, boulder-like, mega-lizard, traumatological, and ex-critters. Even more impressive, the output of one morphological rule can be the input to another, or to itself. One can talk about the unmicrowavability of some French fries, or a toothbrush holder fastener box, in which to keep one's toothbrush holder fasteners. This makes the number of possible words in a language bigger than immense. Like the number of sentences, it is infinite. Putting aside fanciful coinages concocted for immortality in Guinness, a candidate for the longest word to date in English might be floxinosinihilipilification, defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as the categorizing of something as worthless or trivial. But that is a record meant to be broken. Floxinosinihilipilificational, pertaining to the categorizing of something as worthless or trivial. Floxinosinihilipilificationalize, to cause something to pertain to the categorizing of something as worthless or trivial. Floxinosinihilipilificationalization, the act of causing something to pertain to the categorizing of something as worthless or trivial. Floxinosinihilipilificationalizational, pertaining to the act of causing something to pertain to the categorizing of something as worthless or trivial. Floxinosinihilipilificationalizationalize, to cause something to pertain to the act of causing something to pertain. Or if you suffer from sesquipedaliophobia, you can think of your great-grandmother, your great-great-grandmother, your great-great-great-grandmother, and so on, limited only in practice by the number of generations since Eve. What's more, words, like sentences, are too delicately layered to be generated by a chaining device, a system that selects an item from one list, then moves on to some other list, then to another. When Ronald Reagan proposed the Strategic Defense Initiative, popularly known as Star Wars, he imagined a future in which an incoming Soviet missile would be shot down by an anti-missile missile. But critics pointed out that the Soviet Union could counterattack with an anti-anti-missile-missile-missile. No problem, said his MIT-educated engineers. We'll just build an anti-anti-anti-missile-missile-missile-missile. These high-tech weapons needed a high-tech grammar, something that can keep track of all the antis at the beginning of the word so that it can complete the word with an equal number of missiles plus one at the end. A word structure grammar, a phrase structure grammar for words that can embed a word in between anti and its missile, can achieve these objectives. A chaining device cannot, because it has forgotten the pieces that it laid down at the beginning of the long word by the time it gets to the end. Like syntax, morphology is a cleverly designed system, and many of the seeming oddities of words are predictable products of its internal logic. Words have a delicate anatomy consisting of pieces called morphemes that fit together in certain ways. The word structure system is an extension of the X-bar phase structure system in which big nounish things are built out of smaller nounish things. Smaller nounish things are built out of still smaller nounish things, and so on. The biggest phrase involving nouns is the noun phrase. A noun phrase contains an n-bar. An n-bar contains a noun, the word. Jumping from syntax to morphology, we simply continue the dissection, analyzing the word into smaller and smaller nounish pieces. Here is a picture of the structure of the word dogs. end stem, dog, and inflection, z, dogs. The noun allows the docking maneuver in which the whole word can be plugged into the noun slot inside any noun phrase. Down inside the word, we have two parts, the bare word form dog, usually called the stem, and the plural inflection, zzz. The rule responsible for inflected words, the rule of Wug test fame, is simply N consists of N stem and inflection. A noun can consist of a noun stem followed by a noun inflection. The rule nicely interfaces with the mental dictionary. Dog would be listed as a noun stem, meaning dog, and zzz would be listed as a noun inflection, meaning plural of. This rule is the simplest, most stripped-down example of anything we would want to call a rule of grammar. In my laboratory, we use it as an easily studied instance of mental grammar, allowing us to document in great detail the psychology of linguistic rules from infancy to old age in both normal and neurologically impaired people. In much the same way that biologists focus on the fruit fly, Drosophila, to study the machinery of genes. Though simple, the rule that glues an inflection to a stem is a surprisingly powerful computational operation. That is because it recognizes an abstract mental symbol, like noun stem, instead of being associated with a particular list of words or a particular list of sounds or a particular list of meanings. We can use the rule to inflect any item in the mental dictionary that lists noun stem in its entry without caring what the word means. We can convert not only dog to dogs, but also hour to hours, and justification to justifications. Likewise, the rule allows us to form plurals without caring what the word sounds like. We pluralize unusual-sounding words, as in the Gorbachevs, the Box, and the Mao Zedongs. For the same reason, the rule is perfectly happy applying to brand new nouns, like faxes, dweebs, wugs, and zots. We apply the rule so effortlessly that perhaps the only way I can drum up some admiration for what it accomplishes is to compare humans with a certain kind of computer program that many computer scientists tout as the wave of the future. These programs, called artificial neural networks, do not apply a rule like the one I have just shown you. An artificial neural network works by analogy, converting wug to wugged because it is vaguely similar to hug-hugged, walk-walked, and thousands of other verbs the network has been trained to recognize. But when the network is faced with a new verb that is unlike anything it has previously been trained on, it often mangles it, because the network does not have an abstract, all-embracing category verb stem to fall back on and add an affix to. Here are some comparisons between what people typically do and what artificial neural networks typically do when given a WUG test. Verb, male. Typical past tense form given by people, mailed. Typical past tense form given by neural networks, membled. Conflict, conflicted, conflafted. Wink, winked, walk. Quiver, quivered, quests. Satisfy, satisfied, sedated. Smerf, smerfed, sprurice. Trilb, trilbed, treelit. Smeege, smeeged, leaflog. Frilg, frilged, frizzled. Stems can be built out of parts, too, in a second, deeper level of word assembly. In compounds like Yugoslavia report, sushi lover, broccoli green, and toothbrush, two stems are joined together to form a new stem by the rule N stem consists of N stem, N stem. A noun stem can consist of a noun stem followed by another noun stem. In English, a compound is often spelled with a hyphen or by running its two words together, but it can also be spelled with a space between the two components, as if they were still separate words. This confused your grammar teacher into telling you that in Yugoslavia report, Yugoslavia is an adjective. To see that this can't be right, just try comparing it with a real adjective like interesting. You can say, this report seems interesting, but not, this report seems Yugoslavia. There is a simple way to tell whether something is a compound word or a phrase. Compounds generally have stress on the first word, phrases on the second. A dark room, phrase, is any room that is dark, but a dark room, compound word, is where photographers work, and a dark room can be lit when the photographer is done. A blackboard, phrase, is necessarily a board that is black. But some blackboards, compound word, are green or even white. Without pronunciation or punctuation as a guide, some word strings can be read either as a phrase or as a compound, like the following headlines. Squad helps dog bite victim. Man eating piranha mistakenly sold as pet fish. Juvenile court to try shooting defendant. New stems can also be formed out of old ones by adding affixes, prefixes, and suffixes like the al, eyes, and ation are used recursively to get longer and longer words ad infinitum, as in cessationalizationalization. For example, ubble combines with any verb to create an adjective, as in crunch-crunchable. The suffix -er converts any verb to a noun, as in crunch-cruncher, and the suffix -ness converts any adjective into a noun, as in crunchy-crunchiness. The rule forming them is a stem consists of stem, a stem affix. An adjective stem can consist of a stem joined to a suffix. And a suffix like -ubble would have a mental dictionary entry like the following. -ubble, adjective stem affix, means capable of being -ext. Attach me to a verb stem. Like inflections, stem affixes are promiscuous, mating with any stem that has the right category label, and so we have crunchable, scrunchable, schmooshable, wuggable, and so on. Their meanings are predictable. Capable of being crunched, capable of being scrunched, capable of being schmooshed, even capable of being wugged, whatever wug means. Though I can think of an exception. In the sentence, I asked him what he thought of my review in his book, and his response was, unprintable. The word unprintable means something much more specific than incapable of being printed. The scheme for computing the meaning of a stem out of the meaning of its parts is similar to the one used in syntax. One special element is the head, and it determines what the conglomeration refers to. Just as the phrase, the cat in the hat, is a kind of cat, showing that cat is its head, a Yugoslavia report is a kind of report, and schmooshability is a kind of ability. So report and ability must be the heads of those words. The head of an English word is simply its rightmost morpheme. Continuing the dissection, we can tease stems into even smaller parts. The smallest part of a word, the part that cannot be cut up into any smaller parts, is called its root. Roots can combine with special suffixes to form stems. For example, the root Darwin can be found inside the stem Darwinian. The stem Darwinian, in turn, can be fed into the suffixing rule to yield the new stem Darwinianism. From there, the inflectional rule could even give us the word Darwinianisms, embodying all three levels of word structure. Interestingly, the pieces fit together in only certain ways. Thus, Darwinianism, a stem formed by the stem suffix -ism, cannot be a host for -ian, because -ian attaches only to roots. Hence, Darwinismian, which would mean pertaining to Darwinism, sounds ridiculous. Similarly, Darwinsian, pertaining to the two famous Darwins, Charles and Erasmus, Darwinsianism and Darwinsism are quite impossible, because whole inflected words cannot have any root or stem suffixes joined to them. Down at the bottommost level of roots and root affixes, we have entered a strange world. Take electricity. It seems to contain two parts, electric and itty. But are these words really assembled by a rule, gluing a dictionary entry for itty onto the root electric like this? N-stem consists of N-root suffix. A noun stem can be composed of a noun root and a suffix. Itty, noun root suffix, means the state of being X. Attach me to a noun root. Not this time. First, you can't get electricity simply by gluing together the word electric and the suffix itty. That would sound like electricity. The root that itty is attached to has changed its pronunciation to electris. That residue, left behind when the suffix has been removed, is a root that cannot be pronounced in isolation. Second, root affix combinations have unpredictable meanings. The neat scheme for interpreting the meaning of the whole from the meaning of the parts breaks down. Complexity is the state of being complex, but electricity is not the state of being electric. You would never say that the electricity of this new can opener makes it convenient. It is the force powering something electric. Similarly, instrumental has nothing to do with instruments. Intoxicate is not about toxic substances. One does not recite at a recital. And a 5-speed transmission is not an act of transmitting. Third, the supposed rule and affix do not apply to words freely, unlike the other rules and affixes we have looked at. For example, something can be academic or acrobatic or aerodynamic or alcoholic, but academicity, acrobaticity, aerodynamicity, and alcoholicity sound horrible, to pick just the first four words ending in ick in my electronic dictionary. So, at the third and most microscopic level of word structure, roots and their affixes, we did not find bona fide rules that build words according to predictable formulas, WUG style. The stems seem to be stored in the mental dictionary with their own idiosyncratic meanings attached. Many of these complex stems originally were formed after the Renaissance, when scholars imported many words and suffixes into English from Latin and French, using some of the rules appropriate to those languages of learning. We have inherited the words, but not the rules. The reason to think that modern English speakers mentally analyze these words as trees at all, rather than as homogeneous strings of sound, is that we all sense that there is a natural breakpoint between the electric and the itty. We also recognize that there is an affinity between the word electric and the word electricity, and we recognize that any other word containing itty must be a noun. Our ability to appreciate a pattern inside a word, while knowing that the pattern is not the product of some potent rule, is the inspiration for a whole genre of wordplay. Self-conscious writers and speakers often extend Latinate root suffixes to new forms by analogy, such as religiosity, criticality, systematicity, randomicity, insipidify, calumnate, conciliate, stereotypy, disaffiliate, gallinage, and shavian. The words have an air of heaviosity and seriosity about them, making the style an easy target for parody. A 1982 editorial cartoon by Jeff McNelly put the following resignation speech into the mouth of Alexander Haig, the malaprop-prone Secretary of State. "I decisioned the necessification of the resignatory action option due to the dangerosity of the trend-flowing of foreign policy away from our originacious careful coursing towards consistency, purposity, steadfastnitude, and above all, clarity." Another cartoon, by Tom Tolles, showed a bearded academician explaining the reason verbal scholastic aptitude test scores were at an all-time low. Incomplete implementation of strategized programmatics designated to maximize acquisition of awareness and utilization of communications skills pursuant to standardized review and assessment of languaginal development. In the culture of computer programmers and managers, this analogy making is useful for playful precision, not pomposity. The New Hacker's Dictionary, a compilation of hackish jargon, is a near-exhaustive catalog of the not-quite-freely extendable root affixes in English. Ambidextrous, adjective, capable of operating a mouse with either hand. Barfulous, adjective, something that would make anyone barf. Bogosity, noun, the degree to which something is bogus. Bogotify, verb, to render something bogus. Bozotic, adjective, having the quality of Bozo the clown. Cuspy, adjective, functionally elegant. Depeditate, verb, to cut the feet off of, e.g., while printing the bottom of a page. Dimwittery, noun, example of a dim-witted statement. Geekdom, noun, state of being a techno-nerd. Marketroid, noun, member of a company's marketing department. Mumblage, noun, the topic of one's mumbling. Pessimal, adjective, opposite of optimal. Wedgitude, noun, the state of being wedged, stuck, incapable of proceeding without help. Wizardly, adjective, pertaining to expert programmers. Down at the level of word roots, we also find messy patterns in irregular plurals like mouse mice and man men, and in irregular past tense forms like drink, drank, and seek sought. Irregular forms tend to come in families like drink, drank, sink, sank, shrink, shrank, stink, stank, sing, sang, ring, rang, spring, sprang, swim, swam, and sit, sat. Or blow, blew, know, knew, grow, grew, throw, threw, fly, flew, and slay, slew. This is because thousands of years ago, Proto-Indo-European, the language ancestral to English and most other European languages, had rules that replaced one vowel with another to form the past tense, just as we now have a rule that adds ed. The irregular or strong verbs in modern English are mere fossils of these rules. The rules themselves are dead and gone. Most verbs that would seem eligible to belong to the irregular families are arbitrarily excluded, as we see in the following doggerel. Sally Salter, she was a young teacher who taught, and her friend Charlie Church was a preacher who prought, though his enemies called him a screecher who scrought. His heart when he saw her kept sinking and sunk, and his eye, meeting hers, began winking and wonk, while she in her turn fell to thinking and thunk. In secret he wanted to speak and he spoke, to seek with his lips what his heart long had soak. So he managed to let the truth leak, and it loak. The kiss he was dying to steal, then he stole. At the feet where he wanted to kneel, then he know. And he said, I feel better than ever I foal. People must simply be memorizing each past tense form separately, but as this poem shows, they can be sensitive to the patterns among them, and can even extend the patterns to new words for humorous effect, as in hag speak and hack speak. Many of us have been tempted by the cuteness of sneeze snows, squeeze squoze, take took tooken, and shit chat, which are based on analogies with freeze-froze, break-broke-broken, and sit-sat. In Crazy English, Richard Lederer wrote an essay called Foxen in the Hen Heist, featuring irregular plurals gone mad. Booth, beef. Harmonica, harmonicky. Mother, methrin. Drum, draw. Kleenex, kleenices. And bathtub, bathtubim. Hackers speak of faxen, vaxen, boxen, meese, and McIntosh. Newsweek magazine once referred to the white-capped, rhinestone-studded Las Vegas entertainers as Elvi. In the Peanuts comic strip, Linus's teacher, Mrs. Othmar, once had a class glue eggshells onto model Igli. Maggie Sullivan wrote an article in the New York Times calling for strengthening the English language by conjugating more verbs as if they were strong. Subdue, subdid, subdone. Nothing could have subdone him the way her violet eyes subdid him. Seesaw, saw-saw, seen-saw. While the children saw-saw, the old man thought of long ago when he had seen-saw. Pay, pew, pain. He had pain for not choosing a wife more carefully. And snare, and snore, and snorn. In the 60s and 70s, Summonix ads ensnore many who had never been ensnorn by ads before. Commemorate, commemorate, commemoratin'. At the banquet to commemorate Herbert Hoover, spirits were high, and by the end of the evening many other Republicans had been commemoratin'. In Boston, there is an old joke about a woman who landed at Logan Airport and asked the taxi driver, "Can you take me someplace where I can get scrod?" He replied, "Gee, that's the first time I've heard it in the pluperfect subjunctive." Occasionally, a playful or cool-sounding form will catch on and spread through the language community, as catch caught did several hundred years ago on the analogy of teach taught, and as sneak snuck is doing today on the analogy of stick stuck. I am told that has tooken is the preferred form among today's mall rats. This process can be seen clearly when we compare dialects which retain the products of their own earlier fads. The curmudgeonly columnist H.L. Mencken was also a respectable amateur linguist, and he documented many past tense forms found in American regional dialects like heat-het, similar to bleed-bled, drag-drug, dig-dug, and help-hope, tell-told. Dizzy Dean, the St. Louis Cardinals pitcher and CBS announcer, was notorious for saying, "He slid into second base," common in his native Arkansas. For four decades, English teachers across the nation engaged in a letter-writing campaign to CBS demanding that he be removed, much to his delight. One of his replies during the Great Depression was, "A lot of folks that ain't saying ain't eatin'." Once he baited them with the following play-by-play. "The pitcher wound up and flanged the ball at the batter. The batter swung and missed. The pitcher flanged the ball again, and this time the batter connected. He hit a high fly right to the center fielder. The center fielder was all set to catch the ball, but at the last minute his eyes were blonded by the sun, and he dropped it." But successful adoptions of such creative extensions are rare. Irregulars remain mostly as isolated oddballs. Irregularity in grammar seems like the epitome of human eccentricity and quirkiness. Irregular forms are explicitly abolished in rationally designed languages like Esperanto, Orwell's Newspeak, and Planetary League auxiliary speech in Robert Heinlein's science fiction novel Time for the Stars. Perhaps in defiance of such regimentation, a woman in search of a nonconformist soulmate recently wrote this personal ad in the New York Review of Books. "Are you an irregular verb who believes nouns have more power than adjectives? Unpretentious, professional, divorced white female, 5-year European resident, sometime violinist, slim, attractive, with married children, seeking sensitive, sanguine, youthful man, mid-50s to 60s, health-conscious, intellectually adventurous, who values truth, loyalty, and openness." A general statement of irregularity in the human condition comes from the novelist Marguerite Yourcenar. "Grammar, with its mixture of logical rule and arbitrary usage, proposes to a young mind a foretaste of what will be offered to him later on by law and ethics, those sciences of human conduct, and by all the systems wherein man has codified his instinctive experience. For all its symbolism about the freewheeling human spirit, though, irregularity is tightly encapsulated in the word-building system. The system as a whole is quite cuspy. Irregular forms are roots, which are found inside stems, which are found inside words, some of which can be formed by regular inflection. This layering not only predicts many of the possible and impossible words of English. For example, why Darwinianism sounds better than Darwinismian. It provides a neat explanation for many trivia questions about seemingly illogical usage, such as, why in baseball is a batter said to have flied out? Why has no mere mortal ever flown out to center field? Why is the hockey team in Toronto called the Maple Leafs and not the Maple Leaves? Why do many people say Walkmans rather than Walkmen as the plural of Walkman? Why would it sound odd for someone to say that all of his daughter's friends are lowlives? Consult any style manual or how-to book on grammar, and it will give one or two explanations as to why the irregular is tossed aside. Both wrong. One is that the books are closed on irregular words in English. Any new form added to the language must be regular. Not true. If I coin new words like to re-sing or to out-sing, their pasts are re-sang and out-sang, not re-singed and out-singed. Similarly, I recently read that there are peasants who run around with small tanks in China's oil fields, scavenging oil from unguarded wells. The article calls them oil mice, not oil mouses. The second explanation is that when a word acquires a new, non-literal sense, like baseball's fly out, that sense requires a regular form. The oil mice clearly falsify that explanation, as do the many other metaphors based on irregular nouns which steadfastly keep their irregularity. Sawteeth, not sawtooths. Freud's intellectual children, not childs. Snowmen, not snowmans, and so on. Likewise, when the verb to blow developed slang meanings like to blow him away, assassinate, and to blow it off, dismiss casually, the past tense forms remained irregular. Blew him away and blew off the exam, not blowed him away and blowed off the exam. The real rationale for flied out and Walkmans comes from the algorithm for interpreting the meanings of complex words from the meanings of the simple words they are built out of. Recall that when a big word is built out of smaller words, the big word gets all its properties from one special word sitting inside it at the extreme right. The head. The head of the verb to overshoot is the verb to shoot. So overshooting is a kind of shooting. And it is a verb because shoot is a verb. Similarly, a workman is a singular noun. Because man, its head, is a singular noun, and it refers to a kind of man, not a kind of work. Crucially, the percolation conduit from the head to the top node applies to all the information stored with the head word, not just its nounhood or verbhood, and not just its meaning, but any irregular form that is stored with it, too. For example, part of the mental dictionary entry for shoot would say, I have my own irregular past tense form, shot. This bit of information percolates up and applies to the complex word, just like any other piece of information. The past tense of overshoot is thus overshot, not overshooted. Likewise, the word man bears the tag, my plural is men. Since man is the head of workmen, the tag percolates up to the N symbol, standing for workman, and so the plural of workmen is workmen. This is also why we get outsang, oil mice, saw teeth, and blew him away. Now we can answer the trivia questions. The source of quirkiness in words like fly out and walkmans is in their headlessness. A headless word is an exceptional item that, for one reason or another, differs in some property from its rightmost element, the one it would be based on if it were like ordinary words. A simple example of a headless word is a low life, not a kind of life at all, but a kind of person, namely one who leads a low life. In the word low life, then, the normal percolation pipeline must be blocked. Now, a pipeline inside a word cannot be blocked for just one kind of information. If it is blocked for one thing, nothing passes through. If low life does not get its meaning from life, it cannot get its plural from life either. The irregular form associated with life, namely lives, is trapped in the dictionary, with no way to bubble up to the whole word low life. The all-purpose regular rule, add the S suffix, steps in by default, and we get low lives. By similar unconscious reasoning, speakers arrive at saber-tooths, a kind of tiger, not a kind of tooth, tenderfoots, novice Cub Scouts, who are not a kind of foot, but a kind of youngster that has tender feet, flatfoots, also not a kind of foot, but a slang term for policemen, and still lifes, not a kind of life, but a kind of painting. Since the Sony Walkman was introduced, no one has been sure whether two of them should be Walkmen or Walkmans. The non-sexist alternative, Walkperson, would leave us on the hook, because we would be faced with a choice between Walkpersons and Walkpeople. The temptation to say Walkmans comes from the words being headless. A Walkman is not a kind of man, so it must not be getting its meaning from the word man inside it, and by the logic of headlessness, it shouldn't receive a plural form from man either. But it is hard to be comfortable with any kind of plural, because the relation between Walkman and man feels utterly obscure. It feels obscure because the word was not put together by any recognizable scheme. It is an example of the pseudo-English that is popular in Japan in signs and product names. For example, one popular soft drink is called Sweat, and T-shirts have enigmatic inscriptions like Circuit Beaver, Nurse Mentality, and Bonoractive Wear. The Sony Corporation has an official answer to the question of how to refer to more than one Walkman, fearing that their trademark, if converted to a noun, may become as generic as aspirin or Kleenex, they sidestep the grammatical issues by insisting upon Walkman personal stereos. What about flying out? To the baseball cognoscenti, it is not directly based on the familiar verb to fly, to proceed through the air, but on the noun of fly, a ball hit on a conspicuously parabolic trajectory. To fly out means to make an out by hitting a fly that gets caught. The noun, a fly, of course, itself came from the verb to fly. Since the whole word, represented by its topmost label, is a verb, but the element it is made out of, one level down, is a noun, to fly out, like low life, must be headless. If the noun fly were its head, fly out would have to be a noun too, which it is not. Lacking a head and its associated data pipeline, the irregular forms of the original verb to fly, namely flew and flown, are trapped at the bottommost level and cannot bubble up to attach to the whole word. The regular ED rule rushes in its usual role as the last resort, and thus we say that Wade Boggs flied out. What kills the irregularity of to fly out, then, is not its specialized meaning, but its being a verb based on a word that is not a verb. By the same logic, we say, they ringed the city with artillery, formed a ring around it, not they rang the city with artillery. And he grandstanded to the crowd, played to the grandstand, not he grandstood to the crowd. This principle works every time. Remember Sally Ride, the astronaut? She received a lot of publicity because she was America's first woman in space. But recently, Mae Jemison did her one better. Not only is Jemison America's first black woman in space, but she appeared in People magazine in 1993 in their list of the 50 most beautiful people in the world. Publicity-wise, she has out-Sally-rided Sally Ride, not has out-Sally-ridden Sally Ride. For many years, New York State's most infamous prison was Sing Sing, but since the riot at the Attica Correctional Facility in 1971, Attica has become even more infamous. It has out-Sing-Singed Sing Sing, not has out-Sing-Sung Sing Sing. As for the maple leaves, the noun being pluralized is not leaf, the unit of foliage, but a noun based on the name maple leaf, Canada's national symbol. A name is not the same thing as a noun. For example, whereas a noun may be preceded by an article like the, a name may not be. You cannot refer to someone as the Donald unless you are Ivana Trump, whose first language is Czech. Therefore, the noun a maple leaf, referring to, say, the goalie, must be headless, because it is a noun based on a word that is not a noun. And a noun that does not get its nounhood from one of its components cannot get an irregular plural from that component either. Hence, it defaults to the regular form maple leaves. This explanation also answers a question that kept bothering David Letterman throughout one of his recent late-night shows. Why is the new Major League Baseball team in Miami called the Florida Marlins rather than the Florida Marlin, given that those fish are referred to in the plural as marlin? Indeed, the explanation applies to all nouns based on names. I'm sick of dealing with all the Mickey Mouses in this administration. Not Mickey Mice. Hollywood has been relying on movies based on comic book heroes and their sequels, like the three Supermans and the two Batmans, not Supermen and Batmen. Why has the second half of the 20th century produced no Thomas Manns, not Thomas Men? We're having Julia Child and her husband over for dinner tonight. You know, the Childs are great cooks, not the children. Irregular forms, then, live at the bottom of word-structure trees, where roots and stems from the mental dictionary are inserted. The developmental psycholinguist Peter Gordon has capitalized on this effect in an ingenious experiment that shows how children's minds seem to be designed with the logic of word structure built in. Gordon focused on a seeming oddity first noticed by the linguist Paul Kaparsky. Compounds can be formed out of irregular plurals, but not out of regular plurals. For example, a house infested with mice can be described as mice-infested, but it sounds awkward to describe a house infested with rats as rats-infested. We say that it is rat-infested, even though by definition one rat does not make an infestation. Similarly, there has been much talk about men bashing, but no talk about gays bashing, only gay bashing. And there are teeth marks, but no claws marks. Once there was a song about a purple people eater, but it would be ungrammatical to sing about a purple babies eater. Since the licit irregular plurals and the licit regular plurals have similar meanings, it must be the grammar of irregularity that makes the difference. The theory of word structure explains the effect easily. Irregular plurals, because they are quirky, have to be stored in the mental dictionary as roots or stems. They cannot be generated by a rule. Because of this storage, they can be fed into the compounding rule that joins an existing stem to another existing stem to yield a new stem. But regular plurals are not stems stored in the mental dictionary. They are complex words that are assembled on the fly by inflectional rules whenever they are needed. They are put together too late in the root-to-stem-to-word assembly process to be available to the compounding rule, whose inputs can only come out of the dictionary. Gordon found that 3 to 5-year-old children obeyed this restriction fastidiously. Showing the children a puppet, he first asked them, "Here is a monster who likes to eat mud. What do you call him?" He then gave them the answer, "A mud eater," to get them started. Children like to play along, and the more gruesome the meal, the more eagerly they fill in the blank, often to the dismay of their onlooking parents. The crucial parts came next. A monster who likes to eat mice, the children said, was a mice eater. But a monster who likes to eat rats was never called a rats eater, only a rat eater. Even the children who made the error mouses in their spontaneous speech never called the puppet a mouse's eater. The children, in other words, respected the subtle restrictions on combining plurals and compounds inherent in the word structure rules. This suggests that the rules take the same form in the unconscious mind of the child as they do in the unconscious mind of the adult. But the most interesting discovery came when Gordon examined how children might have acquired this constraint. Perhaps, he reasoned, they learned it from their parents by listening for whether the plurals that occur inside the parents' compounds are irregular, regular, or both, and then duplicate whatever kinds of compounds they hear. This would be impossible, he discovered. Motherese just doesn't have any compounds containing plurals. Most compounds are like toothbrush, with singular nouns inside them. Compounds like mice-infested, though grammatically possible, are seldom used. The children pronounce mice-eater, but never rats-eater, even though they had no evidence from adult speech that this is how languages work. We have another demonstration of knowledge despite poverty of the input, and it suggests that another basic aspect of grammar may be innate, just as Crane and Nakayama's Jabba experiment showed that in syntax, children automatically distinguish between word strings and phrase structures. Gordon's mice-eater experiment shows that in morphology, children automatically distinguish between roots stored in the mental dictionary and inflected words created by a rule. A word in a word is complicated. But then, what in the world is a word? We have just seen that words can be built out of parts by morphological rules. But then what makes them different from phrases or sentences? Shouldn't we reserve the word word for a thing that has to be rote memorized, the arbitrary Saussurean sign that exemplifies the first of the two principles of how language works, the other being the discrete combinatorial system? The puzzlement comes from the fact that the everyday word word is not scientifically precise. It can refer to two things. The concept of a word that I have used so far in this chapter is a linguistic object that, even if built out of parts by the rules of morphology, behaves as the indivisible smallest unit with respect to the rules of syntax. A syntactic atom, in Adam's original sense of something that cannot be split. The rules of syntax can look inside a sentence or phrase and cut and paste the smaller phrases inside it. For example, the rule for producing questions can look inside the sentence, "This monster eats mice," and move the phrase corresponding to mice to the front, yielding, "What did this monster eat?" But the rules of syntax halt at the boundary between a phrase and a word. Even if the word is built out of parts, the rules cannot look inside the word and fiddle with those parts. For example, the question rule cannot look inside the word mice-eater in the sentence, "This monster is a mice-eater," and move the morpheme corresponding to mice to the front. The resulting question is virtually unintelligible. What is this monster, an eater? Answer, mice. Similarly, the rules of syntax can stick an adverb inside a phrase, as in, "This monster eats mice quickly." But they cannot stick an adverb inside a word, as in, "This monster is a mice-quickly eater." For these reasons, we say that words, even if they are generated out of parts by one set of rules, are not the same thing as phrases, which are generated out of parts by a different set of rules. Thus, one precise sense of our everyday term, word, refers to the units of language that are the products of morphological rules, and which are unsplittable by syntactic rules. The second, very different sense of word refers to a rote memorized chunk, a string of linguistic stuff that is arbitrarily associated with a particular meaning. one item from the long list we call the mental dictionary. The grammarians Anna Maria di Schulo and Edwin Williams coined the term listeme, the unit of a memorized list, to refer to this sense of word. Their term is a play on morpheme, the unit of morphology, and phoneme, the unit of sound. Note that a listeme need not coincide with the first precise sense of word, a syntactic atom. A listeme can be a tree branch any size, as long as it cannot be produced mechanically by rules, and therefore has to be memorized. Take idioms. There is no way to predict the meaning of kick the bucket, buy the farm, spill the beans, bite the bullet, screw the pooch, give up the ghost, hit the fan, or go bananas from the meanings of their components using the usual rules of heads and role players. Kicking the bucket is not a kind of kicking, and buckets have nothing to do with it. The meanings of these phrase size units have to be memorized as listemes, just as if they were simple word-sized units, and so they are really words in this second sense. Di Schulo and Williams, speaking as grammatical chauvinists, describe the mental dictionary, lexicon, as follows. If conceived of as the set of listemes, the lexicon is incredibly boring by its very nature. The lexicon is like a prison. It contains only the lawless, and the only thing that its inmates have in common is their lawlessness. In the rest of this chapter, I turn to the second sense of word, the listeme. It will be a kind of prison reform. I want to show that the lexicon, though a repository of lawless listemes, is deserving of respect and appreciation. What seems to a grammarian like an act of brute force incarceration, a child hears a parent use a word and thenceforth retains that word in memory, is actually an inspiring feat. One extraordinary feature of the lexicon is the sheer capacity for memorization that goes into building it. How many words do you think an average person knows? If you are like most writers, who have offered an opinion based on the number of words they hear or read, you might guess a few hundred for the uneducated, a few thousand for the literate, and as many as 15,000 for gifted wordsmiths like Shakespeare. That is how many distinct words are found in his collected plays and sonnets. The real answer is very different. People can recognize vastly more words than they have occasion to use in some fixed period of time or space. To estimate the size of a person's vocabulary, in the sense of memorized listemes, not morphological products, of course, because the latter are infinite, psychologists use the following method. Start with the largest unabridged dictionary available. The smaller the dictionary, the more words a person might know, but not get credit for. Funk and Wagnall's New Standard Unabridged Dictionary, to take an example, has 450,000 entries, a healthy number, but too many to test exhaustively. At 30 seconds a word, 8 hours a day, it would take more than a year to test a single person. Instead, draw a sample, say the third entry from the top of the first column on every eighth left-hand page. Entries often have many meanings, such as hard, 1, firm, 2, difficult, 3, harsh, 4, toilsome, and so on. But counting them would require making arbitrary decisions about how to lump or split the meanings. Thus, it is practical only to estimate how many words a person has learned at least one meaning for, not how many meanings a person has learned altogether. The testee is presented with each word in the sample and asked to choose the closest synonym from a set of alternatives. After a correction for guessing, the proportion correct is multiplied by the size of the dictionary, and that is an estimate of the person's vocabulary size. Actually, another correction must be applied first. Dictionaries are consumer products, not scientific instruments, and for advertising purposes, their editors often inflate the number of entries. Authoritative, comprehensive, over 1.7 million words of text and 160,000 definitions, includes a 16-page full-color atlas. They do it by including compounds into fixed forms whose meanings are predictable from the meanings of their roots and the rules of morphology, and thus are not true listemes. For example, my desk dictionary includes, together with sail, the derivatives sailplane, sailor, sailless, sailing boat, and sailcloth, whose meanings I could deduce even if I had never heard them before.